Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, climate change is the great challenge of our time. It's a problem so big that tackling it requires cooperation on a scale we've never seen before. Our reliance on fossil fuels means that most aspects of our lives as individuals and the economies we rely on contribute to rising temperatures. And the food and drink industry is central to that. There is no getting away from the fact that the global food and drink industry is one of the largest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions, estimated to make up 20 to 30% of the total. Now, targets have been set and good work is being done, and we've covered it extensively on this podcast, but there is plenty more still to do. So how is the food industry doing when it comes to its net zero targets? How do we speed up the pace of change? And what challenges lie ahead? Well, with me to discuss this are two brilliant guests. Andy Wright is Director of Responsible Business at Samworth Brothers. Hello there, Andy.
Hello, Stefan. Nice to meet you.
Great to have you with us. And Emma Pearcy is Head of Climate Change and Energy Policy at the Food and Drink Federation. Hello there, Emma.
Hello, Stefan. And good to be with you again.
Great to have you here with us again. The United Nations has set a target of achieving net zero emissions by 2050. That means cutting greenhouse gas emissions to as close to zero as possible. The UN says we're not on track. Current government targets globally fall short of what's needed. So, Emma, is the food and drink industry in the UK on track with its commitments? What's your view?
Well, I think it'd be fair to say that, of course, that, you know, with the recent Chris Skidmore review on net zero, with, you know, the IPCC reports that have come out, there are very much concerns about industry as a whole, cross-industrial sector, of being able to meet this net zero by 2050 target. And, of course, for us, we had it by 2040. And I think the reality is that we also have challenges to meet that target. So, you know, we have an interim by a 50% reduction by 2030 with RAP, which is, you know, aligned to that 1.5 degrees target. And we can see, you know, what is necessary in order to achieve it. But beyond 2030, the progress is very much contingent on other, say, stakeholders. So, for example, you know, on grid infrastructure, the decarbonisation of the electricity grids, the role, you know, of hydrogen, for example. We also, you know, have international supply chains. So there is a lot of work for us to do, obviously, both in the short term and meeting the interim targets. But beyond, we need to really start planning as a country and with other industrial sectors on those interdependencies that we all share. So there is a lot to be positive about, and we've got that 1.5 degrees in mind to keep us with that, but we don't have all the answers yet, and I think that would be the fair thing to say.
And are there any particular sectors or sections of the food industry that are struggling in particular with their reduction targets?
That's a really good question. I think, again, you know, when we see some of the larger organisations and the multinationals, they do have a lot more resource than your smaller organisations. And when we look at food and drink manufacturing, it's about 96-97% SMEs. So whilst there are definitely some SMEs that have really made a lot of progress, the reality is that for a lot of them, particularly over the last few years with COVID, with Brexit, the Ukraine war, there is a lot of focus around now, frankly, around survival and dealing with these current challenges. So, you know, when it comes to working on sustainability and these issues, they are in need of more support. And so that is something that, you know, as a trade association, we're very conscious of and now building that capacity to be able to help these organisations more. As indeed we see, you know, with government and its focus also on SMEs. It's one of the challenges we have, but there are certainly examples across the supply chain of a lot of great work that is underway.
Now, you obviously support, you represent a huge diverse amount of people, but so this is slightly naughty questions, but are there any companies that are leading the way, any that you'd like to point out as doing particularly good work?
Yeah, Yes, I was thinking about this earlier, and you know, one particular example which I like from a smaller company actually, it is Alara. Now, Alara was the first manufacturer to produce a net zero carbon cereal after I think it was in early 2021, and just this year, its full range is now net zero. Mm. So you know, that's one example, and they really embed sustainability more broadly across, you know, in each of the different pillars, social, economic, environmental, and the governance. That's a smaller example. But then when we look to perhaps larger companies, you know, the work that Nestlé has been doing, for example, around recycling their Nespresso capsules, and that they're a co-founder of Podbat, for example, which is where anyone, anywhere in the country can recycle their pods, you know, through curbside collection or that kind of thing. And you know, you get that circular economy aspect with it. I mean, Appetito, that's another interesting one. When we look at net zero and the role of sort of consumer behavioural change, they've done some work with the St George's University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust in looking at a new low carbon emissions menu, and you know, helping patients in this context then actually, you know, choose lower emission options on the menu. I mean, there's a full range across all the different aspects of sort of the emissions footprint of food. Mm. We've got examples, you know, that companies are working on each of those. So whether it's your scope 1 and 2 emissions, you know, your on-site, you know, your factory emissions, whether it's with transport, whether it's the packaging, refrigeration and cooling, the ingredients. And of course, at the end, you know, with consumers too, there's some really great work going on across all those areas, which I think does also highlight, you know, how important this is, that we all work together across that supply chain and that very collaborative effort, because we all have a stake in getting these emissions to drop.
Yeah. Now, there seems to be a bewildering amount of sort of rules and protocols and targets and programs. But what I've heard about more and more recently, and it's talked about certainly in the food industry, is the greenhouse gas protocol, and that there are three types of emissions that companies need to keep in mind, named scope 1, scope 2 and scope 3. Can you explain what these three types of emissions are? And I believe that there's one that is proving more tricky than others to really conquer.
That is true. That is very true. So scope 1 emissions are the emissions that a company makes directly. So, for example, burning or combusting gas in order to generate heat or steam in their boilers, for example. Scope 2 is where you are importing the electricity or energy, you know, on site for your heating and cooling, or you know, what is being produced through importing that energy on site. Now, for actually food and drink manufacturers, that's roughly 6 to 10% of the emissions footprint of what they produce. So that, as you correctly mentioned, the big area and the most tricky area is around the scope 3 emissions. So in this category are all the emissions that are not associated directly with the company itself are in there. So I think the biggest portion of that, for example, is ingredients. Now, when we look at the role of ingredients in the carbon emissions footprint, roughly that is sourced from half of this from UK ingredients in terms of the embodied carbon, and the other half is from that international dimension. So that's food that's imported from abroad. So that's where you start to see some of the complexity. In fact, when we look at scope 3 emissions, for food and drink, that's probably one of the most complex of all the different industrial sectors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Andy, you've been very well behaved, and you've been waiting for a long time for me to ask you a question. So let's dig in deep into what scope 1 and scope 2 emissions and the problems that they pose. What have companies been doing to mitigate these, and what more could they be doing?
Thanks, Stefan. So more holistically, business has been focused on energy reduction and efficiency primarily for many years as a cost out program. But now there's also a focus on net zero strategies. So rather than simply focusing on energy efficiency, we're also looking at decarbonising. And to work towards decarbonisation, RAP, the UK Climate Action NGO, advises businesses to focus on target, measure and act. And I'll kind of pull each one of those apart a little bit. So the first step, target, is really around setting science-based targets so we know where we're heading. And targets are considered science-based when they align with the scale of reductions required to keep global temperature increases well below 2 degrees compared to pre-industrial levels. And those targets can then be externally validated by the science-based target initiative. The second step is measure. So understanding your baseline, figuring out how you're going to get to your destination target, hopefully having a robust roadmap to reach net zero. And I think you can also add accountability in here, enhancing delivery of the plan through clear governance and incentivization as well. And then finally, act. And I think there's some really big levers here that we can pull. So the first one being improving energy efficiency. So a big focus on automated monitoring and targeting, process optimization, really around known low-cost solutions. Certainly sourcing renewable electricity and having a plan for on-site renewables, switching to sustainable refrigerants for our cooling systems. And then the final one's around decarbonizing our heat processes. Most manufacturing companies, the final elimination of carbon relates to heating, and we use a lot of gas for cooking and cleaning and for hot water. And we need a longer-term plan for either how to electrify those processes or to obtain heat from other sources, be that heat pumps, solar thermal, or alternative fuels like potentially hydrogen in the future.
Hydrogen in the future. That's the classic, isn't it? I've always thought hydrogen is the future, and lots of people say, yes, it will always be the future, which is awesome. But there's such a lot of exciting work being done in this area. Now, we've talked to quite a few people about these areas, and there is a huge amount of innovation for both these sort of scope one and scope two. We've seen lots of companies doing automatic data harvesting and measuring and things like that. I think the classic comment that we've always got is, until you measure it, you can't solve a problem. And so actually, as you say, it's those going through those steps is absolutely vital. It sounds like a mantra and it sounds like a bit of corporate nonsense. It's absolutely vital. You're just not going to get anywhere, are you? Okay, the Carbon Trust says that Scope 3 emissions represent the majority for food companies' carbon footprint. So tell us about the challenges there. I mean, is it ingredients Emma's talking about? I mean, it suddenly gets incredibly complex now, doesn't it?
Yeah, certainly. And Scope 3 is complex even to measure, let alone mitigate. But, you know, optimism and the power of optimism. But within measuring, I suppose the vast majority of businesses are doing this through currently the use of proxy factors to determine an overall footprint of the ingredients that they're purchasing.
And can you explain what the concept of proxy factors are?
So rather than going out and collecting actual data from primary production, i.e. farms, we're using academic data to say, you know, the carbon footprint of a pepper is X grams, and we'll take an academic study to use that particular factor rather than going and gathering the data, primarily as it takes too long to go and gather that data.
And expensive to do.
Yeah. So at the moment, the majority of data is being collected in that way. In time, we're going to need to replace that data with much more accurate supply chain data. And engage with supply chains to be able to do that. So really big part is measuring. Once you know what it looks like, then there are really two big levers in my head that we can pull to mitigate. The first of those is around decarbonizing the ingredients by, again, working with supply chain partners on some really chunky issues in the supply chains, including things like deforestation. And the second is through ultimately changing our products and our portfolios. And I suppose, in my view, this is going to need to provide the biggest element of our reduction plans as we review the use of carbon-intense ingredients within our products.
Now, it strikes me that, as you say, you know, the phrase supply chain data is dropped easily, but that is just a can of worms, isn't it? Are we looking at blockchain issues here where data is going to be integral to the whole process and that nothing's really going to happen on a global scale until we can have the certainty of data, as in the sort of data you get from blockchain?
I think there are numerous ways that data is coming online and becoming available to us, and numerous industry collaborative actions that are taking place right now to give us the data that we need to enable us to have the conversations around changing stuff ultimately.
Now, Emma, how are companies going about tackling Scope 3 and getting supply chains on board with net zero?
Yes, so very much, you know, obviously following on from Andy's comments just now, I mean, I think it was actually today that RAP announced that they are joining with WWF and eight of the UK's largest retailers to standardise measurement and reporting of greenhouse gas emissions from food and drink. And one of the really, let's say, exciting things around this is actually that then the retailers themselves will have a standardised approach on how they engage with the manufacturers, our members, and further down the chain. Because one of the problems at the moment is that actually we, as manufacturers, are getting differing requests from the different retailers. So when we, you know, when we talk about action and how we're going about tackling this, well, we do need that level playing field. So, you know, this approach to data, and you know, you mentioned blockchain, we'll also see progress within this area in terms of the Food Data Transparency Partnership that has recently been launched by DEFRA following the National Food Strategy. So, of course, this is only sort of one element to tackling Scope 3 emissions. Whilst doing that at the same time, we can also already start to put in place changes that will help reduce that emissions footprint. So I mentioned Appetito a short while ago, for example, looking at the ingredients and, you know, looking at some swapping to lower embodied carbon ingredients. I think, you know, another aspect, as mentioned already, is working with suppliers. And recently, I think it was in September last year, you know, issued guidance to help manufacturers, for example, working with suppliers and standardise that way in which we engage to get that information. So that will help. Other projects, I mean, okay, we've talked a lot about carbon, but actually sort of more holistically, when we talk about climate change, we, you know, it's both responding to the causes and the consequences of climate change. Mm. So in southern Spain, which is one of the top 10 most at-risk areas for water security, RAP is working with a number of manufacturers on a project in that area to help reduce that risk and how we engage with that area. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that are going on, both, let's say, locally, you know, within the UK, but also looking at that international dimension as well.
It's interesting because you mentioned a food data transparency project. On one level, it's the most boring phrase on the planet. And yet, on the other hand, it's probably the thing that will make the most amount of difference. It's an extraordinary paradox with those sorts of projects.
Indeed. And so perhaps just to add on to that, it's very important as well, because when we talk about the role of consumers and consumer behavioural change, there is a lot of talk around labelling and, you know, carbon labelling or environmental labelling. We need good data for that. And so that is what we hope the FDTP will help provide.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Andy, you've got some extraordinary experience working, you know, in the thick of this from a manufacturer's point of view. So what have been the easiest and crucially the most difficult changes to actually implement?
So I think figuring out a plan is relatively easy in the first place. I think costing that plan into investment cycles is more tricky. Mm. And this has got to become mainstream, not core business on one side and sustainability on the other. So we need to be able to embed into core processes ultimately. And that return on investment, especially at the minute, is a key challenge. So short-term focus is fine when projects deliver a payback of 1 to 3 years, but it gets much harder with longer-term paybacks of 5 to 10 years. However, I suppose the challenge that I'm conscious of is that 10 times 1 year plans don't necessarily add up to deliver 1 times 10 year plan. And we've got to be really conscious of that. Mm. From my perspective, we can support that through embedding in processes, things like including a cost of carbon and whole life costs into any CapEx decisions that we make. So ultimately, every penny we do spend is spent making this easier, not harder.
Mm. Do you feel that that your role has changed from being the in-company hippie that is there basically to be ignored and you know, passed on the back to a sort of a crucial accountancy executive? I mean, has there been a fundamental sea change in the way that your role has been viewed?
I'm not sure I've gone from hippie to accountant. That seems quite a big stretch. Hopefully a bit of both. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. It's more about cross-party governance and being able to embed this within business and get the different actors within a business to understand what this means and work together collaboratively.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, Emma, let's talk about the economics of this. Is it possible to maintain profits? I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, I'm sure there'll be lots of gnashing of teeth, but at some point there will be some sustainability taxes coming in. It can't be that far away on the horizon. Is it possible to maintain profits at the moment or even grow them as most businesses want to whilst achieving net zero?
It's my first point. It's essential to maintain profitability, because when we think about sustainability, you know, that's a social, economic, and environmental. If businesses can't function, if they can't make a profit, then we won't have them there. So, you know, for a sustainable and resilient food system, that's very important to maintain. I think your point around like the inevitability of taxes, I'm not so sure about that. But what I would say is that we really need an open, honest and transparent conversation about how much this can cost, and to have those conversations around how that's paid for. Because at the moment, you know, we have this cost of living crisis. We see double digit inflation month on month, you know, with food, for example. And we have serious issues around fuel poverty and food poverty. And yet, you know, I recall a couple of years back with an HM Treasury report into the costs of meeting net zero, they did outline that the role that food has to play. And, you know, it was a good proportion of households' carbon footprint. But then they failed to talk about the cost. And I also remember another phrase. I think Nicholas Stern, in his report on the economics of climate change, I think about 20-odd years ago now, the costs of inaction are greater than the costs of action. So we can't stick our heads in the sand about this. And, you know, I think it's really good that we're having this conversation, because we need to start examining this and, you know, and thinking about these challenges and how we're going to overcome them.
Well, I was just going to build on Emma's point, actually. I think we can get really negative in this space, doom and gloom. But I think this is about mindset change as well. Are we seeing this as a cost or as an opportunity?
Good point.
And from my perspective, we need to be solutions focused and optimistic. This can be done, ultimately.
Mm. And has to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the economics of it a little bit more. Who should take responsibility for financing the changes that are needed? So we ran an online poll and asked the question, who should pay for this? 81% of people said food and beverage companies should bear the financial costs. Less than a quarter felt it was down to consumers. So who should shoulder the financial burden of achieving net zero? Is it the consumer, the food and beverage company, the farmer, or is it something the government should fund? Because either way, however it's funded, it ends up being paid for by the consumer, either in raised prices or somewhere. But where that money comes from may define how this unfolds. So this question for both of you. Emma, starting with you, where do you think the impetus should come from?
Yes, a very good introduction to that. And because that shows that some of the challenges, I think, from a consumer point of view, and understanding how these things work, I would say it's every stakeholder. It's the farmers, it's the manufacturers, it's consumers, it's the government. I saw a recent article even the last week. I think it was maybe based in Belgium or the Netherlands, possibly, which was, you know, looking at some of these challenges, and they do start to talk about how you tackle some of the social issues. And I think this will be something that we need to do, because, you know, we see what's happened. If you look at the evolution of the energy markets, perhaps over the last 15, 20 years, and how they've started to engage effectively in social policy, that just shows that we've got these challenges which we'll need to address. I don't think, quite clearly, food banks should not be our answer to some of the challenges that we're seeing on that side. So I think we've got a lot of questions which as stakeholders, we will need to really work together to work on what those solutions are. But certainly, all of us as stakeholders have got responsibility. And food waste, as one example, there's something that we can all do ourselves as consumers from the start. 70% of food waste happens in the home, 2/3 of which could have been eaten. We can have an immediate impact on reducing our food bills and reducing carbon simply by reducing waste. Mm. That's perhaps another topic in itself of how to do it. But you see what I mean by, you know, I think we've each got some responsibilities.
Yeah. Andy, do you have any views on this? I mean, it's partly about whether or not there's a level playing field for food and beverage companies to implement these changes that are needed. Where do you think the financing should be rooted?
I think the message is consistently clear from numerous surveys, including your survey, Stefan, but from citizens, they expect retailers and manufacturers to sort these issues out and ultimately to not sell them unsustainable products. And I think responsible businesses are getting after this in a really big way.
Now, amongst all of this, how can companies go about retaining things like product quality and consumer choice? I mean, is there a sense, Andy, within companies that to achieve these things, something's got to give?
Great topic of conversation that I have on a regular basis. What I'd say is when the ground moves beneath your feet, adjust your footing. And historically, the food industry has focused on delivering food that was safe, tasty, good value, ultimately a three-legged stool of food safety, food quality and cost. But that's just not enough. And the fourth leg of that stool is there. Food has to factor in sustainability as well. And for me, this is therefore not about choosing one leg of the stool above another, but balancing our approach so we don't fall over. And yeah, this is really complex stuff. An old CEO of mine used to say, we're just going to have to learn to run and chew gum at the same time. And yeah, that's the case.
Okay, well, it's a tough one though, isn't it? So Emma, now consumers clearly have a role to play in this. They might make choices based on sustainability, but over the last year, the cost of living crisis has meant that choices are harder to make, especially if you're already not having a choice because you're on the lowest income rung. And so you are already trying to buy the most affordable foods anyway. But are there any emerging trends in consumer behaviour that could help or hinder the food and drink industry's sustainability efforts?
I mean, I think there are a lot of positive trends that we are seeing. I think the younger generation as a whole is clearly becoming increasingly engaged in sustainability topics. And really, as they move into adulthood and older, there is a thought that actually, again, that will help the momentum with companies to continue in order to continue maintaining or growing that market share with that segment. Equally, at the same time, you know, as cost pressures become more prevalent as people, you know, grow their families, will that be maintained? And we'll see. At the same time, though, we also see there's quite a big growth in vegan and plant-based products. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to recognise that this is not a silver bullet as such. We've seen with Nestlé's recent withdrawal that there's still work to do on outreach and product development, you know, for sort of that mass outreach we need. Wrap recently did their third Love Food, Hate Waste campaign, so the Food Waste Action Week, rather. And, you know, there's some real, that phrase, love food, hate waste, it's a really great phrase that you will start to pick up on packaging now. And, you know, and I think people are understanding more, but there's still a lot more to do on how to reduce food waste. Mm. You know, there are some emerging trends there, and we really need to sort of capitalise those and continue that momentum. But I think one key thing, I think, as we talk about sustainability and you know what it could cost, if people are going to be paying more, people need to be very clear about the benefit. Now, one challenge we have for this, for example, is with EPR. So, you know, we see here that the current proposals will mean that consumers will pay extra to get this plastic packaging recycling. But the current government proposals mean that actually there isn't going to be an uplift in recycling rates. So if things are going to cost extra, that actually consumers can see the benefit. So, again, we've got quite a bit of a role here to make sure that we keep consumers on side and we build that engagement as we progress on this journey.
Yeah, and keeping consumers on side is not helped by programmes sort of being proposed and then being dropped at the last minute, as in Scotland, I guess. Now, which brings me on to another subject, really, which is related to this, and that is there a role for greater legislation here? Now, I can imagine that both the FDF and companies themselves kind of think, well, no, please, we've got enough legislation already. However, the benefit of legislation is it makes a level playing field in theory. Would you like to see mandatory front-of-pack sustainability scores on products? I mean, and you know, is sustainability taxation a way of you know, bizarrely simplifying these things? Andy, any views on this?
Yes. So I think legislation definitely helps where we need to create a level playing field. And eco-labelling, front-of-pack eco-labelling, is one of those areas that I'm definitely supportive of. I think it's coming, and it's coming at pace. And in the most part, that's been voluntary driven by the industry rather than being mandated by government. Mm. And I think that's a really positive mood for the industry. I think we've got to think about what it's there for. It's not necessarily to simply give consumers the information, but obviously it does do that.
And we know that it's a complex area as well. There are lots of, the complexities of sustainability are immense, aren't they? So maybe there's more knowledge that needs to be extended to people as well.
Massively. And what does the label cover? How do we get over that? And it, look, if we wait for perfect, it's going to be a very long time. But I think what we're able to do right now is to give a good indication of the sustainability of products, and we need to be able to do that.
You've got to make a start, really, haven't you? I think you're right. There's a point to that. But Emma, what do you think? I mean, front-of-pack sustainability scores, it's a really complex area, isn't it?
Incredibly complex. And what's really challenging for manufacturers at the moment is that, as I mentioned earlier, you know, they're getting different requests from different retailers with different methodologies. We've got different data sources. Mm. That, when we talk about cost relating to, yes, the price of products, we need to think about these things too. And I think the biggest, though, thing we need to think about is what are the intended outcomes? And if the intended outcome is about behavioural change from consumers, well, we need to make sure that we use all the tools in the toolbox and not hang all of our efforts just on labelling, because there is a risk of preaching to the converted.
Yeah.
And that's what concerns me, that we haven't fully explored, or we need to fully utilise those other issues too. So, I mean, I agree this will be useful, but we must make sure that it won't disengage people by, you know, with data problems or methodologies. You need to compare like with like.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, there's challenges there as well. I think I spoke to one of our members recently, and one of the challenges, for example, is around, in terms of a methodology, do you have the same methodology for all products, for all product categories? Or should you have a different methodology for different product categories, so that you can compare within a category what's the one with the more or less environmental footprint? I mean, there's a lot of challenges here, but I agree, you know, with Andy that there is in a sense a balance, and we you can't forever debate these things, because otherwise you go around in circles. But we need to work out what that middle ground is, I think, in order to strike a balance.
In order to get anywhere. Okay, so Andy, we've had a whole blitz of events, and maybe the world just is constantly bombarding us with stuff that trips us up. But the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, flipping Brexit, I mean, all of these things have had a significant impact on the food and drink industry. Have they affected the industry's progress towards net zero?
Well, I suppose undoubtedly any period of instability and inflation causes turbulence. And for some, that will lead for the need to focus on some very short-term priorities. But I suppose in my eyes, a company isn't a single organism. It's a collection of people working to achieve an aim. And not all those people have to be focused on the same thing at the same time. So it's a little bit of a cop-out to say we can't do more than one thing at once. So although, yes, I think business has lost some of its focus, specifically after, I suppose, we had really great focus post-COP26, not everyone needs to lose focus, and this still needs to be a priority. Those 2030 short-term targets are not too far away now.
Which brings me to my last question, which is about optimism, really. You've both mentioned it in different ways. First of all, optimism on reaching targets and optimism about the potential that we might be able to achieve. Emma, what's looking good from your side?
In terms of, let's say, turning perhaps some negatives into positives, with this focus or the impacts that we've seen from the war in Ukraine and on energy prices, for example, that's really brought, you know, energy efficiency and fuel switching to the fore. We've seen very much an increase in interest, for example, in solar panels. So that I think that's quite encouraging, because that's something that then that will be maintained and, you know, people see that that's the right thing to do. I think otherwise, we see increasing acknowledgement of trying to get things right first time round. The point I was making earlier around EPR and, you know, and making sure that actually we do get the investment in recycling facilities. We need to take this time to make sure that we get those end results, those outcomes that we want. So there is that acknowledgement, and I think that's a positive outcome. And overall, you know, people see that we need to be responding to this cost of living crisis. And again, that helps keep this visibility of sustainability issues at the forefront of companies' minds.
Okay. And Andy, reasons to be excited?
I'm really optimistic about this. I think the mood music has changed. I think what you called me a hippie a bit earlier, Stefan, and I think the
kindness.
The level of conversation it was kindly taken. I think the level of discourse in the industry has changed and become much more mature, and the levels of conversations that we're having now are embedded into core business rather than it being sustainability team talking to sustainability team and basically not getting anywhere. These conversations are embedded into key commercial decisions now, and that's coming down from retailers as well. So, yeah, the scale and pace of change has really stepped on.
So your job's become more important. Are they paying you more as well?
Couldn't possibly comment.
No, you're quite right too. Well, I think that's a brilliant rundown of where we are currently with the net zero target debates. So thanks to both of you for your help. Andy Wright and Emma Pearcey, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.